Hey everyone, this is Connie Morgan with the Free Black God podcast. Today's guest is Wilfred Riley. Will is an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University and the author of the books Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, Hate Crime Hoax, and the upcoming Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, which comes out on June 11th. He is not one to back away from tough subjects, and his research interests include international relations and the prevention of war, contemporary American race relations, and the use of modern quantitative methods to test sacred cow theories such as the existence of widespread white privilege. He's a favorite follow on X, where you can count on him for intelligent laughs. Will has been described by himself as the greatest mind of a generation. All that you decide for yourself. And remember, there is no such thing as the black perspective, just black people with perspectives.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Hey, Will, thank you for joining me today on the Free Black Thought Podcast. You're one of our favorite follows on Twitter and one of the accounts that we probably retweet the most. And so it's awesome to have you here on the podcast today. Lots of different things we can and will talk about, but let's start at the beginning like we do with everybody. Can you please tell us, kind of give us your autobiography? Where did you grow up? How did you get your start, and how did you wind up to where you are today?
Yeah, so I mean, my background is, I guess, reasonably interesting, but I started out as kind of a working class kid. Like, my mom, Jean Ward, was, at least when I was like an older kid and a teenager, an inner city teacher. Like, she was a substitute teacher and then a teacher. And I lived basically where she taught. So I lived in Chicago. I'm originally from Chicago itself. Like, I lived on the south side. I lived in the Wicker Park area, which is right now kind of the Chicago version of Brooklyn. It's our upscale hipster district. A lot of stores selling, you know, like $200 messenger bags and this kind of thing. When I lived there, it was colloquially nicknamed Needle Park. It was an like struggling artist area. So these were all like really urban neighborhoods, kind of that one movie Kids-ish. I moved from there to East Aurora, which was mom's final district. East Aurora is a working class city of maybe 300,000 people, Aurora total, just outside Chicago. Very heavily Hispanic, a lot of Eastern Europeans, a lot of Black Americans. So I like just lived in those environments. Like, all the schools I went to were technically inner city schools. Like, they weren't in the projects or anything, but they were all just like big struggling city schools. Like, kids would come to class with like their skateboards and like read comic books and play cards and stuff. I was in the honors program most of the time, so that minimized it a little bit. But I'm like, my high school tribe, I guess, was like skater or something like that. I was kind of nerdy, and I was also a decent athlete. I was my best sport was long distance running, actually 50 pounds ago. And I probably could have competed at like the D3 level or something like that. But I ended up from that point on, I just went to college. You know, I wasn't actually, this was an advantage. Like, I was a black, fairly poor kid. And so, I mean, I had pretty good test scores. But when I applied to most of these schools, I found myself getting in. Like, I was waitlisted at Yale, which surprised me, but I got into most of the Illinois schools. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going to Southern Illinois University. At least that's where I finished my college career. I went from there to law school at the University of Illinois. And I went on from there to, and by this point, like, things are pretty conventional. It's not any more like wild, like living in the hood, crazy friends experiences. Like, I mean, I went to law school. You know, I didn't do extraordinarily well there, but I mean, just finished in good standing and all that. So at this point, it's like reading law books and like thinking about what big firm you're going to work for in Illinois or Michigan. But things got a little different than from the life path I expected. I was offered a PhD at Southern Illinois again, and I went down to SIU. This is a part of a program called DFI, Diversifying the Faculty of Illinois, and pursued the PhD path for a bit. But during this period, and I was doing pretty well there. Like, I had a couple publications and so on. But during this period, my mom got quite sick. So I came back to Chicago to sort of help her out. I lived in Chicago and then in Aurora. And I went through about an 8-year stretch where I had all these crazy, like, city kid jobs. So, like, I was a canvas field manager for the Human Rights Campaign, which is a group that campaigns for gay and, at the time, women's rights. We were backing the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And the job is like literally basically standing out in the street, getting in arguments with people. So I would take a crew of people to like the south side of Chicago and ask questions like, hey, got a minute for gay rights? And people would, you know, try to fight you. People would like give you hundreds of dollars. Like, we actually, from Chicago and New York, you actually travel around the country. Those are kind of like the varsity offices. So like, we went to Southern Illinois. I didn't go on this one, but we went to Tennessee. So that's why my bio says Freedom Rider. Like, there were all these groups of kids going around the country stumping for gay rights. Mm-hmm. And this is before Obergefell. So, like, people were wildly hostile. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there were times when people from this group would get in brawls in, like, the same city where Martin Luther King's boys did. Mm-hmm. But they were with diverse groups of people. Like, it would be, like, a black guy and a white guy. Like, you faggots, get out of here. Excuse the language. So, I mean, I did this for a while. And eventually I just got tired of it. Like, I mean, you canvass during the winter. Mm. And like the scuffling and so on can be a bit exaggerated, but like the actual conditions are pretty bad. Mm-hmm. You get paid pretty well, by the way. Like, none of the people doing street activism, especially for the left, are volunteers, which is something that's worth noting. Like, there's a book called Activism Inc. about this.
Yeah.
I mean, there's generally a baseline amount of money that you have to make per day, something on the order of $200, and you make 15 or 25% of everything over that. And if you're good, I mean, you're signing people up for, say, $49 a month recurring. So you're making, I mean, it would be not unusual for me to make, say, $2,000 in a good day.
Wow.
And then some percentage of that, not the full $2,000. But the conditions themselves are terrible. Like, you're just standing out on Michigan Avenue, it's 5 degrees, and, like, people are yelling at you and so on. So I eventually got sick of that. And although I think we did some good, like the year I quit was the year that gay marriage happened. Mm-hmm. And like our like young warriors were at like the Pride Parade when this happened. And like this entire people got their freedom and people were like dancing and crying and breaking down the streets. It was actually quite moving. And then, of course, like civil rights groups tend to be pretty amoral and scuzzy. So like once that glorious thing happened, they immediately just swung toward trans rights. Like I actually got so disgusted with the HRC, I stopped giving 2 years later. Mm-hmm. So just as with like the election of Barack Obama and so on, like as you get older, you live to see the things you idealistically believed in collapse, which moves most people toward a sort of cynical conservatism. Like, eh, give me my gun and my land. Yeah. I'm going to get married. Yeah. It's all bullshit. But anyway, so that was a fun urban experience. And like the canvassers definitely are not discouraged from like hooking up and traveling together and, you know, so on. Like, you make some genuine friendships in the group and that kind of thing. So basically that went on for some period of time. And after that period ended, I went to work in one of the other classic urban guy jobs, which is basically a trading floor. I was actually on kind of the upper end sales side instead, but I worked for Marcus Evans North American headquarters. Mm-hmm. This is a well-known kind of like aggressively, let's say competitive versus something like sketchy British company. But their whole job, their business model is contacting the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and bringing them into these high-end business summits in places like Honolulu with the smaller scale CEOs that our job as executives for the company was to recruit. So we had to find things like the personal cell phones for CEOs and convince them to pay us, let's say in the 5 to 6 figures, to come to these business events. And it was an interesting competitive job. Like, we were in that LaSalle Street, Michigan Avenue corridor in Chicago, probably it was second to Wall Street or an equivalent location in Ciudad de Mexico, but you know, it almost exactly the same across for the North American continent. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a couple of years. Like, I'd show up in my 3-piece and scream at people on the phone. And I mean, like, again, it's entirely, that's a very competitive job. Like, the baseline salary for a month, if you don't make any sales, is like $1,000. Mm. But if you do, again, it's like 20% of 100,000 or whatever you sell, and you can close like 2 or 3 of them in a month. So it was one of the kind of young urban learning experiences. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. And by that point I had money. So my next job was teaching in the city colleges, which is just like a, kind of the epitome of urban, almost inner city teaching. I mean, like Malcolm X College is one of the Chicago City Colleges. I actually taught at Harry Truman, but I mean, you basically just get on the train, you go to the hood and you teach kids. I did some much more informal coaching at this period. I've coached for like the Fox Valley Park District in Aurora and so on. Like, the goal is to keep kids out of gangs, that kind of thing. So at the end of that period, I mean, there'd been like a 95% income drop during that job transition. So at the end of this period, like, I started applying for collegiate jobs. My PhD was finishing up. And I got to the interview stage with quite a few. You know, and you can make jokes. Like, I don't think being a minority legacy hurt me, although I'm not exactly sure I'm a legacy. Mm-hmm. But I also was pretty qualified by this point. I mean, I had the PhD in hand. I had the law degree. Yeah. And generally, the rule in academia is that you're going to go to a college that's parallel to or a half step below where you attend. So from the University of Illinois or SIU, you would be looking at, you know, Kentucky State, like, it's sort of the directional, perfectly good schools, Western Michigan, that kind of thing. And that those were the sort of places where I was interviewing, and most of them seemed pretty interested. And when I saw Kentucky State, which is a historically black college in Appalachia, I mean, it seemed like a good chance to actually help kids. Mm-hmm. Like the majority of the kids would be African American, or they would be from like the Kentucky Highlands. A lot of them would be first generation college students. And although I'm kind of an asshole in that urban guy sense, like I basically walk in the light. So it seemed like a positive thing to do. And I took the job, and I've been here now 8 years or something like that. I mean, since 2016, so quite a while.
What kind of classes are you teaching?
Well, as a college professor, you generally teach a variety. My focus, what I was basically hired for, is sort of a pre-law track. Yeah. So I teach constitutional law, con law two, which is constitution and civil liberties. I'm our sub professor for American government, so I'll usually handle one out of about three large sessions of intro to, you know, this is Thomas Jefferson, this is George Washington, this is, you know, the Greeks came before the Romans and they both inspired us, that kind of thing. But I'll usually fill in at least one more class during a semester. So you'll teach at a research two university, often what's called a 3-3 or 4-4. So my other class could be almost anything. I've taught counterterrorism. Mm. I've taught cybersecurity and hacking, which is interesting. Like, we showed students how to use Tor, go on the dark net, and so on. I mean, obviously, we didn't let them commit any crimes.
Sure.
But, you know, sure. Well, I mean, now, once they have the tools, they can do whatever they want, but we didn't encourage it. But this semester, my alternative class is just stats.
And do you get to decide what that is? Like, your department gets together and say, we want to offer this class. Who wants to teach it? Like, how are those decisions made? I've always been curious about kind of those extra special classes.
Well, you'd usually have a departmental meeting or something like that. But I mean, it's pretty understood. Like, there will be, we have a political science coordinator who's this, he's our Africanist. He's this slightly older gentleman named Dr. Abadife, who I believe is from Lagos in Nigeria, or Abuja in Nigeria. And I mean, he'll contact me and the other guys that are, I guess, technically working for him in the division and say, okay, we need a 322 professor. That's legislative process. Riley, are you available to do that? And I mean, almost everyone would say yes if you've taught the class before. I mean, it'd be considered quite rude to just say, no, that's beneath me. You know, that garbage. But I mean, sometimes people will say something like, perhaps we need an adjunct for that one if there's a huge freshman session of, you know, remedial government or something like that. But most of our classes, like if I've taught a class before, I'll take the class. And once everyone's got four classes, we'll get on the line, we'll call University of Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, and see if they have any good grad students that want to adjunct to class, that kind of thing. So you'll just fill them in. You can also recommend classes yourself. Like, I haven't gotten around to doing this just because nobody really wants to teach extra classes for no money, as popular as this might be with fans of, you know, well-known professors or something. But like, I've designed a Thomas Sowell class that I'm going to teach at some point called something like Black Conservative Thought, a focus on Sowell. Mm-hmm. So if I said I wanted to teach that, I mean, I think we just put it on the schedule mm-hmm. and it would fill up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So in practice, it's a collaborative process. You just talk with your colleagues.
Okay. Okay. Have you always been online? Like, have you always had this? When did you start kind of becoming this online figure?
Well, I've always known how to use a computer. I mean, so like, actually, that's not really true. Like, when I was in high school, I was pretty broke. So like, computers came out in the mid to late 90s. I mean, it became a popular thing and I didn't have one. I remember until a year or two into college, I would just write papers longhand because I was a readable cursive and print mm-hmm. writer. And it would take maybe 2 hours to do that. And even now, like before I type something up, like if I'm writing a book chapter and it's only 12 pages long, I'll usually write it out. This is actually one reason I'm often kind of late on deadlines, which irritates people, but it gives me a good way to read through something without sitting in front of a computer and reading the same thing five or six times in incomplete form. But I mean, you know, as soon as I got money and bought a computer, I mean, I've been pretty familiar with what they do. I mean, I think I wired into Facebook and at the time MySpace and so on about the time those platforms started. And I mean, I wasn't always an internet figure, but I think I became aware pretty quickly of what they could do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So on MySpace in college, one of the things that I would do going back almost to undergraduate school was promote parties and so on to make money.
Yeah.
And they were pretty popular, pretty legitimate. We didn't have a lot of fights or other incidents. So, I mean, people came to them. People still sometimes bring them up to me. And as a result of that, like, a lot of people would just add me on these platforms, Facebook mm-hmm. and the old Spaces and so on. And I would also just add people. Mm-hmm. Like, if someone looked familiar or attractive or like someone that I'd seen in class or anything else, like a potential buddy of mine, I would just reach out and politely ask, like, hey, can I be your friend or something like this? And everyone would say, yeah, like, I'm a likable enough guy. So I rapidly got to thousands of followers across both of these platforms. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty funny. So I would just say the things I thought. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I thought Bush was an idiot at the time, the then president. And moving on, I thought Barack Obama wasn't quite, but I thought he considered himself a messianic Jesus-like figure. Mm-hmm. So I would make fun of politicians. I would talk about sexuality and relationships. I would talk about sports and sports gambling, which at the time was illegal. So a lot of people just followed me. Mm-hmm. And myself and my buddy Ozzy actually started doing the social media marketing. This would probably be 2011 I'm actually not going to list all these companies. I don't know if all of them, they've generally reacted well to me talking about it online, but I don't know if all of them want to have this discussed. Some of them are still being marketed by friends. But we started doing the social media marketing for large scale sort of nightlife brands and so on in the Chicago, Aurora, Naperville area. And that was a kind of a new lesson. Like, you have to upload this information about this event several times a day. You have to add all these people that fit this demographic. So at one point we made a list of words that represented people that might be interested in, you know, these events. It was like party, kickster, champagne, mm-hmm. artist, goth, you know, like, and we just added all the people that fit these things from friendly pages and so on. So we rapidly got up to the limit on our personal, like, social media pages, and we're creating other accounts in the names of our promoters and so on. So there was a very large scale social media interactivity even at that time. Mm-hmm. And like, Facebook at the time was trying to like chase us and shut down some of our accounts. Wow. Not like our clients, which are like fan pages, but like, they have these rules, like, you're only supposed to be you online and all this stuff. So yeah. it was kind of fun. And we learned how to easily get around that, how to use Tor, how to use VPNs. So like, I became fairly tech savvy pretty early on. And again, this is like urban nightlife culture in the 2010s. Like, friends of mine were actual hackers. Like, I had buddies that had like whole valises of like pirated content, like sitting in their house and so on. So from there, I more on like the just mainstream business side of that, I got into some other platforms. Twitter, I didn't start until several years ago. But when I was in graduate school, obviously I'm not still, you know, throwing parties. So mm-hmm. I took some of the political commentary to other platforms, and the growth on Twitter was pretty rapid. Like, I started, people have only been getting paid, unless you're willing to sell subscriptions and do a whole bunch of other crap, which I'm not, mm-hmm. but on Twitter for less than a year. So yeah. Originally, again, it was just out of pure interest, book promotion, mm-hmm. reuniting with old friends. But I mean, I have 110,000 Twitter followers right now, which isn't bad. Mm-hmm. So people just started pursuing and following the page pretty quickly. But that's because of those skills, I think, that were picked up over, you know, 10 years of doing different social media stuff, and just online marketing for myself and small companies and that kind of thing.
So when you think about your presence on Twitter now, do you think of yourself as just, I just comment on the culture that frequently intersects with politics? Do you see yourself as like a political voice? Are you just like, hey, this is just me. This is just my personality. Like, how do you kind of think about your brand on Twitter?
I mean, kind of like fact-based cultural commentary. One of my things is that a while ago, I decided not to tell lies. I'm a fairly amoral person. Like, I'm quite honorable, but I don't believe that there's a personal God who sends you to hell if you do bad things. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that any rules are real. And it's important to remember this, by the mm-hmm. way. Like, when people take principles that should guide you to some extent, but like, do no harm, and extend them to idiotic, logical extents, you wind up saying moronic things, like you shouldn't harm military enemies in war or prey animals or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that ethics are a result of the operation of logic and the human empathic sense within the brain, and they should best be conceptualized as general principles that should guide you most of the time. And I could go on about this at length if you want, but anyway, like, basically, I decided that for whatever reason, kind of personal amusement, I wasn't going to lie. Like, I would come to the boundary of it, but wouldn't cross it. There are a lot of actual reasons for that. Like, a liar needs a very good memory.
Yeah.
I didn't want to keep track of bullshit that I had said in the past that I didn't believe. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that guides some of my content. Like, I want all the things that I say to be true, or at least mm-hmm. defensible. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually a professional statistician. I mean, and that's a pretentious sounding way of describing myself, because I'm just a college teacher. But, like, I teach our stats classes at a state-level university. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of times it's possible to look at something that's being said very publicly and simply see whether it's true or not. And although I'm obviously, you know, a business type of guy from the center right, I try to apply that to the right and the left roughly equally. Mm-hmm. And I find that almost everything the American political left says in empirical terms is false. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I've watched you guys at Free Black Thought just deconstruct some of this crap very effectively. But I mean, you're talking about, for example, the Ibram Kendi argument that disparities between large groups prove discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the stupidest popular arguments ever made, to some extent. I mean, the mm-hmm. modal average age for a black man, how I'll usually start my response, is mid-20s. For a white guy, it's over 55. So you have to adjust for this 30-year gap. It's 10 years even at the mean before you can talk about anything, before you can talk about income, but also crime rates on the right, so on. So a lot of these left-wing claims are just nonsensical. They're dumb, low IQ, but not picking on any individual person there. But you're now seeing a lot of this on the right, too, where people are saying things like, oh, well, planes are falling out of the sky because all the pilots are black. And you can just look at that, and like, only 3% of the pilots are black, and they're the best pilots. Like, they're all these military veteran guys. It's like, you can just check that with the FAA. Like, what percentage of your pilots are black, and what's the record of those pilots? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I noted that. I got a pretty hysterical backlash to that, actually, where people are in the comments talking about, like, why are you defending Captain Shaniqua over Captain Sullenberger? And it's just sort of like, well, because Captain Shaniqua doesn't exist. Like, 0.3% of pilots are young black women. That's mm-hmm. that's not a thing. Mm-hmm. And there are many claims like this, like the radical feminist / evangelical claim that porn is destroying society and boosting rates of sex among the youth and so on. Like, rates of sex and dating for high school and college men have actually dropped like 80%. You can think that's good or bad. But if there's any effect from guys sitting around watching porn and shooting each other in video screens, it's that they're not talking to girls. Like, right, that's not true. Like, the thing you're saying is false. So I think that that's an element of my cultural commentary, if you will, that I want it to be based on reality and data. And I don't think I'm the best statistician in the world. I mean, there are people that go a long way beyond like linear and time series regression, but they're mostly working for NASA. Like, I don't think there are too many people that have the same level of ability and that are also like screwing around on computers where they can, you know, reset their IP to different places and where they can manage Twitter and so on mm-hmm. at the same time. So I do think there's a useful role for that.
Well, and I will, you are, you know, you've said like, you're funny, you're an entertaining follow, but it's, you've successfully blended the two, right? Like, you come with the facts, yeah. You come with your receipts, you come with the stats, but you're also just fun to read and engage with. And that's, the nerds aren't always that way. They either like have no personality and they're super dry, or they're awkward or something like that. And you are none of those things, at least online. Though sometimes people are very different in person than they are online.
Yeah, I'm actually the same in person. I think the one difference might be that I'd be kind of shy maybe right now when I meet people. That's not a core thing in my personality at all. Like, I'm actually pretty cocky and relaxed, but I'm going through kind of a growing up phase right now. Like, I'm trying to get back in shape. It's like, I'm just turned 40. I'm trying to get back in shape. I'm giving up drinking. Like, all the, like, need to lose some weight. So if you actually saw me, I might look kind of depressed and harried. Like, I just worked 10 hours. I just got out of the gym, you know, like, I look jittery because I just drank 4 cups of coffee because, you know, that's the alternative drug. Like, I mean, just to alcohol, not to anything like hard body. But I mean, like, I think that in practice, like, if you met me, you'd probably like me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in a year, I'll be an even cooler guy. I don't know. But my personality in person, I think, is very similar to my personality, you know, online or in any other circumstance.
I think generally people that come across as extroverted online are extroverted in person. or I should say, introverts can appear extroverted online when they're introverted in person, but extroverts in person are extroverted online too, typically. It's sometimes I do meet people, though, through this podcast and other ways, where they're super quiet, super shy, almost like hard to talk to even, but like they have no problem typing out words for Twitter, or Instagram, or whatever. And I get that. I sometimes think of myself in a similar way. Like, I'm better at writing things out than just, like, you have experience talking to people on the streets and trying to change minds on the streets and engaging with people that way. A lot of Twitter warriors would not be able to do that.
I think that in almost every case where someone's really extroverted, and I would say this in any sense, like really hostile, really sexual, really whatever online, but not in person, they would be in person if there wasn't for some block in their mind. In the case of like really violent for men, by the way, it's probably good the block is there. Like, it's good that they're, I mean, it's like, it's good. There's social normalcy where people right. just walk up to people like, you bro, you know, like, so yay for manners. But in terms of just like basic extroversion. So for example, when I say like, I'm kind of shy, and I'll just be real. Like I said, I try not to lie. Like for the past couple of years, I've felt mildly down. Like I'm really busy. I'm writing what I hope to be a best-selling book. Like I'm, like I said, I'm trying to get in shape. I'm trying to make lifestyle changes, which suck while you're doing them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very boring to be healthy. it is, like, just sitting around like sober, looking at a plate of vegetables is very dull. You know, like, it's just so like, if I met someone for a dinner date or something, and I'm in a relationship now actually, but if I did that and I just looked like, I don't really care about this. I don't want to be here. You know, like that would be very different from my normal personality, but caused by specific factors in my life. And I think that's very true. Like a lot of people that are online or they're in like the different tribes, like in my high school, it would have been like rave subculture, nerd subculture, feminist subculture, eco subculture, were bullied at some point, abused at some point, like their parents did something. So like, if you can remove that block, and anything from good therapy to psychedelic drugs can, the person would just behave exactly how you'd expect them to. So I don't think there's anyone who's like really hyper animated and funny online who's not in person, who wouldn't be in person if you gave them two glasses of wine or something.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It just, there's some hesitation there that you have to get through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I think that's probably true. So you described yourself as kind of like center right. Have you always identified and had kind of the opinions you're dedicated to not lying now, which has basically led you to be of the center right, I guess, since, in my opinion, I agree with you that a lot of the stuff coming out of the left is just lies, low IQ stuff. Have you always been this way, or did you ever go through a shift?
I think I've always been a normal person. So like every environment that I've been in is just normal and competitive. Like I grew up in the hood, although again, not the hyper ghetto projects, not claiming anything, I didn't gangbang. But like it was understood, like you'd have to fight. Like you'd have to go through your hazing on the team, although nothing extreme. Like you'd have to go through... Like, we didn't have buses in my neighborhood, so the school's like 3 miles away. You have to walk there. It's understood that there's some difficulty in life, and people react to that. And, like, two-thirds of the people are going to go into a blue-collar job or into the military. East Aurora is a big feeder school for the U.S. Army at a pretty elite level. Like, we have a National Guard armory on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Just random guys I knew, like Jason Cartier, a guy on my track team, wanted to be Navy SEALs, got pretty close. So you understand that there are certain things in life that are just true. As a person, and perhaps especially as a man, you accept a certain level of risk in everything you do. It is sometimes necessary to suffer. Mm-hmm. But also, some people are smarter than others. Some people are tougher than others.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole series of other things that go along with that. Like when I talk about relationships, I mean, like, I once made a comment on Twitter that was incredibly banal just to see the reaction. But I think it was like, men like pretty and sometimes younger women, and women on average tend to prefer rich men.
Mm-hmm.
And this is supported by all science ever. Right. Like, yeah. No one
and
disagrees.
Just common sense. Like, everybody knows that's true.
No, but like all these hysterical, it wasn't even like the feminists. Most of the feminists were like, I find that to put mildly offensive, but yeah, that's true. I like men that are rich and good men. But like the men's rights activists were like, oh my God, you son of a bitch, you're betraying the team. Like all these big guys were commenting, like, just because I don't have money. And it was just like, come on with the bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Like this... I don't think you could live in the hood or in any of the other environments I'm about to describe and say, or at least truly believe, that kind of crap. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was one of the environments. And I mean, I went on from there to competitive sports for a while. Again, nothing great, but did that again, varsity level. Went on from there to pretty good colleges, law school, these very competitive jobs like street activism, high end sales and all this bullpen stuff. you know, going for a PhD, law degree, these elite degrees. And in none of these environments are people very bullshit tolerant. Mm-hmm. Like, I imagine the military would be even worse. But, like, you can't go to, like, a law school registrar or, like, a guy sitting on the sales director on a trading floor and sales floor and say most excuses for most things. You know, I didn't make it today because I'm neurodivergent. Okay, you're fired.
Yeah.
Like, there'd just be no conversation there. I'm off on my sales goals, struggling with polyamory and pick up both girls and get the fuck out of here. Like, it just would be none of it. Like, none of that. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's always been in my background. Like, don't make a lot of excuses, show mm-hmm. up prepared to compete. Understand that certain things just are real. Like, men like women, women like men. These questions of does group A view group B as somewhat cowardly? Does group B view group A as somewhat perverse? Like, maybe at the average, but there's not really anything you would do about that. Talk to your partner. Those basic realities of life are just there. So, I mean, that was always a part of my life. And then I think as I got older, I had always been critical of some of the conservative stuff. Like, and I have some true left positions. Mm-hmm. Like, if I were going to sum up my position on national health care, it would be a Frenchman can do it. Why can't we? I mean, as a political scientist, like, I'm aware that we have 9 different healthcare systems in the USA. Mm-hmm. Like, I've helped veteran friends with specifically VA healthcare mm-hmm. and their wives with specifically TRICARE. Mm-hmm. And then there's AA, like the insurance and health insurance. It's specifically for like veterans and their daughters, but only out for 3 generations. And like, if we can do all this, why can't we consolidate that into one program that would cost like 60% as much? Like, mm-hmm. there are legitimate left-wing arguments. But it began to strike me as I progressed through that kind of casual liberal phase that everyone goes through, a lot of which is just based around selfishness. Like, I would like the government to give me free money.
Yeah.
If my girl gets pregnant, I don't want to have a kid. Like, a lot of it's just like trying to dodge responsibility. Like, everyone is an activist at 18. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get drafted. Like, if you look through the major positions I had at that period, they're almost all based around me not wanting to do things.
Yeah.
They're passionate opinions, but like, school should give me free condoms. Like, none of them are very, but none of them are like defensible in light of the opinions of David Hume or something. And I think this is not uncommon, you know, but as I passed through that phase, not only did I fall back on the things that I had learned as a kid that were now being reinforced in bullpens, on athletic fields, so on, I also became aware that a lot of the things around me were obvious problems that had more right-wing, the phrase that comes to my mind in many cases, more masculine solutions. Like, crime in Chicago in the 90s and early 00s was wildly out of control. New York was probably worse, but I mean, Chicago had close to 1,000 murders every year. And the secondary evidence of this was like everywhere, it was all around. Like, you'd get on trains and people would come on the train and just paint graffiti. People would take the giant silver and gold markers and just start writing like Amor de Re, like Latin King love, on the windows. Unless you wanted to get into a violent fist fight, you wouldn't say anything to them. You'd just sort of sit there. Mm-hmm. And like, if you look like a scrappy guy, they wouldn't write on your window. That was a gesture of respect. You know, so you'd just be sitting between like Amor and De Re. Like, this is normal, reading a book. Yeah. And it was like, you realize at some point, like, if there was a cop on the train, that wouldn't happen. And that attitude became very much reinforced over the past, really, decade. The first wave of Black Lives Matter riots began after Trayvon Martin in 2012. It's 2024. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as we've seen, police defunding, police pullback, decreasing stop rates, and a near doubling of the murder rate, at least in the Black community. So, I mean, mm-hmm. that's one example of this becoming a little ossified. I want to hear the next question, so I'll shut up after this. But like, illegal immigration is another thing. I actually tend to think most illegal immigrants are just normal, hardworking guys, but young males commit almost all crime. Mm-hmm. So you can't have 5 million normal, hardworking guys just walk into your country every year. Like, yeah. Where are you from? What is the name on your ID? You? Mm-hmm. What happens if you do commit a crime? Do we now have to house you at our expense?
Right.
You know, the idea is just absolutely absurd. So, I mean, again, when Biden relaxed the border, pulled the Border Patrol over to a processing role, that's what relaxed the border, by the way. You're seeing just tides of people walking across. I've been to the border, and I don't know if people understand how easy it is to commit crimes. Like, to get across the border, all you do is walk 10 miles from a community. As a young athlete, this would take 2 hours. Then mm-hmm. you walk across the border. Mm-hmm. And there's another community 2 miles inside on the U.S. side, and then you go there, and you get on the bus. Yeah. I mean, so that's what's happening. That's how people are crossing the border. So I think we should stop that. So crime, education, fatherhood, there's so many things where the traditional right slanting perspective is obviously correct. And this became more evident as I got older.
Okay. So how did that lead you to write the books that you've written? You have a couple book projects that are already out and available. And then you said you're working on what you hope to be a bestseller. Can you talk about all three of those?
Sure. Yeah, the first book wasn't really, I mean, it's with a conservative publisher, so the title, and I love Gregory, but I will note authors don't generally write their titles. And if you ever talk to like a sci-fi guy, they'll go into this at like ranting length, like, no, I didn't put those models in bikinis with axes on my covers. the title of the first book, like Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Real Race War. My original title was just Hate Crime Hoax. But the point of hate, love to Gregory, though. The point of Hate Crime Hoax is, that's actually a little different from personal right-wing politics. Hate Crime Hoax was a book inspired by the fact that I just noticed that all of the high profile stories of racial conflict on left and in fact on right had collapsed. I mean, now there's some ass kicking videos and so on that didn't, high school fights, that kind of thing. But the major stories like Jussie Smollett, Covington Catholic, Yasmin Saweed, Air Force Academy, where like a general went to this campus to say that white and black kids were at each other's throats, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. Kansas State, where a lunatic was supposedly roaming through the campus, defacing the high-end cars of black students. Just on and on. I mean, Duke Lacrosse, if you want to go back few years. Mm-hmm. Drake University, Goucher College, Wisconsin Parkside, where they supposedly found nooses around the entire campus. None of those turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true, by the way, like I said, for the biggest alt-right cases, like the firefighter who claimed that his truck was destroyed by Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. The McCain volunteer who claimed that someone carved the Barack Obama B into her face while calling her a white bitch. Like, none of them happened. Mm-hmm. Like, if you followed up every major case that you read about in, say, 2015, none of them occurred. Mm-hmm. That's just a statement of fact. I'm sure that there are, as with sexual violence, I'm absolutely sure, like, the 70%+ majority of lower level cases actually reported to actual cops happened. But these national stories that kind of divided the country didn't. Mm-hmm. And I had become aware of this years earlier. I mean, I was a graduate student. I guess it was back in Chicago because I was reading the Tribune and the Journal. And nobody does that in Carbondale, Illinois. Great city, though. And there had been all these cases. There's a guy named Derek Coquilline at the University of Chicago who claimed that this hacker group called the Yushai Electronic Army was deluging him with like murder and rape threats. And there was another case where a student at Michigan Tech was expelled for allegedly threatening to shoot everyone on campus. And there was another case where a bar called Velvet Rope Ultra Lounge was burned to the ground and all this anti-gay stuff was written in there. They had like a popular like college bisexual night, which unsurprisingly drew a whole bunch of people from around the city of Chicago for various reasons. But like this, so there's all this offensive stuff in the bar. The bar is burned to the ground. The ferns are destroyed. And I follow these cases. And at this time, because everyone who leaves like a good college or grad school is kind of a conventional liberal. Mm-hmm. There's sort of a very subtle brainwashing process where like, I mean, I would, if you asked me about a bunch of things, I would just sort of say her body, her choice. Like mm-hmm. It's the ambiance. Like you, almost 93% of the professors are to the political left. Mm-hmm. So when I initially read this stuff, was thinking, my God, how can this sort of racism and homophobia exist in my city? And as it turned out, none of these cases actually occurred. Mm-hmm. Like the Coquilline kid was literally just sending messages to himself. I mean, I actually think I know how he did it now after having gone through some of the computer stuff we've talked about. But the FBI sure did. Like they traced all the IPs and they found out like one was for a computer in like the next room. And so I don't know if they arrested him, but they, you know, the case was definitely closed, right. And he got in some serious trouble over at U Chicago. The Michigan Tech student, that was actually interesting. This is Michigan Tech's an elite engineering school in the Midwest. Small, however. But the fairly elite. But anyway, so the kid had actually put out on Twitter or some equivalent the message, I'm gonna shoot everyone I see a smile tomorrow. Because there had been fighting between, I think, white and black fraternities on the campus. And a campus rival of his had cribbed the message via screenshot and taken out the words, a smile. So it just said, I'm going to shoot everybody. I'm going to shoot every black person. And had sent that to campus security. So the whole thing was a hoax, and it couldn't be exposed as a hoax because the message had been deleted until they actually contacted the social media platform and they got back the original message. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, they were able to do that, and the guy was restored. I'm not going to name him, and he finished his career. He's an engineer now. Mm-hmm. So that became pretty evident 5 months or so down the line. And then finally, it turned out that the Velvet Rope case wasn't a hate crime at all. The guy who owned the bar had owed a lot of people money. And I always throw in some dumb joke, like, it's not a good idea in Chicago. But he'd been hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And he had basically set his own club on fire. So this came out years later when his friend was captured driving drunk in another state and told the police, like, hey, I've got someone I can sort of stool pigeon on. I know a guy who destroyed a business, who committed insurance fraud, who committed all these crimes. And so 18, 19 months down the line, he told the police and the insurance press about this. And they came and got this guy who had already opened up another trendy club called Bonsai Bar, which featured like little trees all over the place. Mm-hmm. So there were actually like authentic Asian bonsai trees scattered throughout the club. And he again was doing like, you know, poly night or whatever. And they came and got him and put him in cuffs and took him away. And by this point, I was just like, these people, like you became very aware that none of this had occurred. And I was curious about how often none of this does occur, if that makes sense. Like how often stories like this are fake. And that was the first book.
Why is it that only the fake ones are elevated? Because only in order to be that fantastical, they have to be fake. I have to imagine in a country this large, there are crazy stories that are true, like true crimes committed against gays, black, whatever, that would be fantastic. But why don't those stories get elevated?
Well, I think the answer to that is that real crime tends to be stupid and mundane. So like the person most likely to kill you is your wife or your husband. Mm-hmm. But I mean, those tend to just be dumb, brutal cases. Like she finds out he's cheating, so she stabs him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or I mean, it's even more likely for men. Like he comes home, gets suspicious, shoots her, drives off, is captured by the police in within 2 miles. Mm-hmm. So when we hear these flamboyant stories that are supposed to illustrate something about America itself, like Jussie Smollett had all the details, right? Like they had a noose, they had bleach, like they were going to dye his beautiful black skin white, you know, it's the coldest day of the year, but cold doesn't stop racism. And he fought them off. Like he was ready to go. He was boxing because a black man never gives in, like all that stuff. Like the first time I heard this, I was just like, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I was right.
Yeah.
And this happens pretty often. Like, I mean, we just now saw, and I'll publicly say, I do not think this happened. Congresswoman Lee claims that she was getting on the members elevator in Congress wearing her congressional pin, like the enameled eagle, to vote. And a random white guy stepped in front of her and said, you can't get on that elevator. That's for members. And she said, well, I'm a member. I'm in a suit. And here's my pin. And he said, who did you steal that pin from? And blocked her way. And she like fought her way past him and went to go vote. This was on like MSNBC. But she won't reveal who the man was and so on. Like, is it a rogue congressional police officer? Is it just like a white man who broke into the building and started accosting minority leaders of the free world? I don't know. I don't believe it. But stories like that tend to be formulated to produce like elegiac emotional appeals. And they're very rarely true.
Okay. So there really isn't like all the true crime is just boring. And it's like every 10 years, something true actually does happen. That's interesting. It wouldn't be. There isn't enough to fuel the newspapers every quarter.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing, unfortunately, with like any crime of this kind, like robbery, sexual assault. I mean, like one of the things that was taken out of the book because it wasn't a hate crime, but was the Rolling Stone rape and sexual violence hoax, where this imaginative student said that the fraternities upstairs had these kind of sex dungeons. Mm-hmm. And there were these sort of story of O style initiations where women were given nicknames like it and abused. And like reading through that, you know, there's an element of righteous anger. Like how could this happen? But there's also an element of this probably didn't occur. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'd assume it's the same thing. Like actual brawls between guys or assaults of women are just probably dumb and ugly. Like it's a bunch of drunk people. Mm-hmm. So like when someone makes up something that sounds like fantasy fiction, it very often might be. Yeah. I think is a good rule with these. And with hate crimes, you see that more than with any other category of crime. Because it's so easy, not to fetishize really, but to kind of draw out your imagination's perception of what these enemy warriors might look like. Mm-hmm. And again, you see the right doing this now too, like it was seven blacks, all big and dark. Like, what? Come on, bro. That did not happen. Like, I mean, if you just ask some question, like, what kind of athletic jerseys were they wearing? What do you mean? Why would you assume that? Like, there's not really a follow-up question. It's just the archetypal image from your mind.
Yeah, I actually think fetishizing is the right word. That's last year I read, because I got it in one of those free little libraries that's just on the street corner sometimes in neighborhoods. I go there and I just pick up books sometimes. And so they had the Underground Railroad. Is it called the Underground Railroad? That book that was turned into a TV show. And it's so bad. It's so like fetishizing, like, you know, something that truly happened in history, slavery, right? But it's just like, I like called it like slave porn to my husband when I was reading it. I was like, this is so terrible. Like but he wants it to, the author like wants it to be true because it gives, it makes his anger more righteous, right? It makes his distrust or hatred or whatever towards the white man more just.
Covered in sweat and blood, his hard black muscles strained. Yeah, there's a whole genre of this type of crap. Yeah, I mean,
it was not great, and it was so fantastic, and there was not a single redeeming character in that book that was white either. Like, even the white characters that you thought would be like, okay, this is a good person, nope, they always turned out to be horrible racists in the end who did horrible things. Like, I think you're totally right. It has become, or maybe it always has been, some kind of fetish. But what are you working on now? Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, again, we see the titling practices of the major publishers. But again, I have a great relationship with this one. This one's coming out with HarperCollins. And I think this title is pretty accurate. It's a response to a very famous book, which is Lies My Teacher Told Me. And Lies My Teacher Told Me came out decades ago, and it was a response to that kind of jingoistic attitude in traditional American education. So the argument of the author, and I don't know how true this was even in the 90s, but at some point it had to be accurate, right? The argument of the author was that American education teaches people kind of a sanitized view of the USA. Like the Pilgrims and the Indians just met up one day and they sat down and ate turkey, and that's how America was. It was good, brave white men coming from across the ocean to civilize the savages. So there are, you know, a number of lies exposed that there was a very low population of Native Americans and this kind of thing. In my book, what I do is point out that for the past 60 years, conservatives telling positive lies about the United States have not been in charge of higher education, to put it mildly. So the actual things you're taught in school are much more likely to be about how evil your ancestors were, especially as a white person, than anything glorifying the USA. And so the book exposes kind of five of those narratives. Like, one of them is slavery was unique to the USA or especially brutal here. And I mean, I just make the point, like, one of the first human words was slave. Like, this book is not necessarily my most intensely researched thing ever, thinking back to academic articles, but it is quite intensely researched. And I mean, like, we looked at some of the articles on, like, the development of language, the development of slavery historically. I mean, there's a word in Sumerian cuneiform that means, like, defeated man from the mountains that became the word for worker. Like, slave is one of the first, like, 25 written human words. And slavery, chattel slavery, where you beat someone in war and then sell them, is one of the four or five oldest human trades. So I talk about Greek slavery, Roman slavery, Sumerian slavery. Hopefully this doesn't become too mind-numbingly boring or slave pornish itself. But I mean, like, Arab slavery, African slavery, and then like Native American practices. Like, the Aztecs didn't keep slaves for long, but they ate them. I give a recipe. So I mean, like, which would actually probably be pretty good if you assume human meat tastes like pork. But I mean, so I go from there. Another one is the Cold War wasn't something made up. There wasn't a Red Scare. There actually were hundreds of communist spies in the United States. Like, as a political scientist, you're normally expected to at least be familiar with the Venona cables if you don't read or if you don't do some work on them. And that is the decoding of our communications with the Russians, or at least of Russia's internal communications, more accurately, during the Cold War era, a little after World War II. And that includes, like, the names and the code names of Russia's spies in the USA. And there are something like 690 names in the Venona cables. And they include all the people that were frantically defended by the American left, like Alger Hiss. Like, those guys all actually were spies. So I talk about this, like, how all these foreign agents came to sit so high in our councils, why that's been denied, why we're still making movies like Trumbo about how innocent people were persecuted. Dalton Trumbo was himself a communist, famously. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I break down the fact that communism was a real threat. 40 countries fell to communism before, you know, our war in Afghanistan. Just other stuff. Native Americans were great warriors and interesting people, but they were not peaceful. Mm-hmm. And so on down the line.
Yeah.
There's a chapter on white flight that I think will be pretty interesting. People have begun saying this recently, but like, white flight from the cities in the 60s wasn't just irrational racism. I mean, there was near military level conflict between black and ethnic white people in a lot of cities. And this is the same time when you saw the 1960s relaxation of punishments of crimes. So like, everybody fled a lot of cities. I mean, the population of Detroit among blacks and whites dropped by, I think, 70%. So what actually happened is an important historical thing to understand so we don't repeat it. Mm-hmm. And it sort of seems like we are repeating it now. If you look at what's happening to the population of New York, Chicago, I mean, cities throughout the country outside of a few states like Florida, you can't have that concentration of crime and filth and expect people to remain in particular places. So that's a new book.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one. One of my favorite books that helped me, because I plan on homeschooling my children, which is a big undertaking, and I just really want to do it right, mm-hmm. obviously. And I'm like, how am I going to approach history and all that kind of thing? Debunking Howard Zinn was like a great tool for me, because I went to high school and we were given a people's history. We were given the narrative that white man bad, you know, communism not so bad. MLK even isn't really painted in a particularly nice light. You know, he kind of gives MLK's flowers a little bit in the book, but, and so I'm very interested in this book that you have coming out. I'm definitely going to get a copy of that. Okay, so we're creeping up here on our timeline. I know you have other things, you're a busy guy, to get to. A little behind the scenes for our listeners. So whenever somebody comes on the podcast, I send them a form, right, to fill out that you received. And I ask, like, what do you want to talk about? Because my idea is, guests come on, they can talk about whatever they want. I don't have an agenda, whatever they want to talk about. But you're the type of guy where you're like, I can talk about anything. And that is true, mm-hmm. right? So what do we talk about? And I'm like prepping for this. And I'm like, okay, what questions am I going to ask Will? And I was like, you know what? We finish every episode with 10 questions. And one of the questions that frequently gets asked to people is, what is your spiciest take? Well, I'm going to tell you what one of my spiciest takes is, because nobody ever asked me, because I'm the host. And you tell me what you think about it, because I know you just have fun opinions, and your way of thinking about things is different than other people. Okay, so my spiciest take, this pisses everybody off, maybe even FB, the guys at FBT are going to pull me off the podcast for this. But my spiciest take is that Republican men, well, this applies to women too, but more so men, Republican men who are unmarried and childless, who are not openly gay, should not be trusted. That's my spiciest take, which means Tim Scott should not be trusted. That's why it really pisses everybody off. What's your response?
Well, I mean, it's a good thing I'm an independent. I mean, I think that's really broad. So, I mean, I'm engaged, I guess.
But you're not a politician. I mean, politicians, like people who are like in the political game, like just a guy I meet on the street. That's different.
No, I'm thinking about that. Like, I think that there's some element of truth to that. Now, it depends what you mean by not trusted. A lot of men have kind of an eternal Peter Pan complex going on right now. Mm-hmm. So one of the things about everything from feminism to modern dating app culture is that if you're a guy with reasonable game, you can enjoy a pretty broad range of sex and dating from the time you actually learn what you're doing for like 23 mm-hmm. through about 39. And then you can settle down, marry someone slightly younger, have like two kids and live your life,
yeah.
which is what a lot of my buddies are doing. Mm-hmm. I myself didn't quite go that route, but I mean, I'll be getting married in like the next year or two, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really hold out for a couple of years. Once the bonds form. But I mean, so I understand why women say that. And obviously there's another reason. There's another reason you might be 40 and not married, especially if you're not in a committed relationship. And that would be that you are, in fact, gay.
Right. And so if you're openly gay, I don't have a problem. You know, if you're openly gay, that's fine. But to me, if you're like it, and it's one thing for a private citizen. I want to be clear. I'm talking about politicians. So like, if you're a private citizen and you're playing the game and you're doing exactly what your buddies are doing or whatever, that's fine. But like, if you're a Republican, if you're a conservative politician, people want to see you married with kids. And so if you have decided that your sexual escapades or whatever, you still won't give them up even for that, to present that picture of like, here I am with my wife and kids, white picket fence, all that, that conservatives love. I don't know. I'm kind of like, or have you not been able to convince a woman to marry you, even though you're like super powerful guy? Like, what is it? What's going on here?
I don't know. I don't know if trusted is the word. I would agree with you that a man who is 40 who is not married is probably either about to get married, which isn't really a big deal, but it could affect kids, gay, or just enjoying a number of sexual relationships with other consenting adults who are things like lawyers and teachers and so on, who don't necessarily want to get married themselves. Mm-hmm. That's not a big deal for a liberal politician at all, if he's just saying that. Like, right, right. A lot of feminist women.
Yeah.
For a conservative politician, I could see it as being a bigger deal. When it comes to not being trusted, the only thing that would make someone in two of those roles, gay or partying, untrustworthy is that they're lying about it.
Right.
And that opens up the door for blackmail. I would say that they're untrustworthy if they're not honest about it. Mm-hmm. So like if someone's 42 and they're known in the club scene, or like the Lindsey Graham rumors, like where almost everyone, when you talk about Lindsey Graham, and no hate for Lindsey Graham if he's listening, but like when people be like, oh, a very confirmed bachelor. Mm-hmm. Someone's got to get to the bottom of why he's such a confirmed bachelor. You know, like, yeah, that does open a door for the Russians or whatever. So I think in those positions where it's known or suspected what's going on, that actually is a weakness. If the guy's just like, Cindy is a corporate lawyer and we haven't settled down yet, I don't really see that as a problem at all.
Is that what Tim Scott is? I don't know, actually. I've never heard somebody ask him, like, why don't you have a wife and kids? Like, what? And he's just one example, but he's just, you know, he ran for president, so he's on top of mind.
I don't think Tim Scott is gay. I think with Tim Scott, there actually is... I think that this might get into some racial and class dynamics. Like, I mean, the women that have been linked to Tim Scott were working class white women, as I understand. Mm-hmm. So the question is that going to affect you politically if you show up with someone that's of another race and that can be attacked as, say, trashy? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone says that doesn't matter. But I mean, in, you know, his state, you're winning elections by 1%.
Yeah.
So if that knocks 7% off you, you know, it's unfortunate if you're dating a personal trainer or something, but... Are you going to pull that up? Nothing against that field, but are you going to pull that up into the public eye if you don't have to? Probably not. I mean, I noticed that the minute after that was said, like, why doesn't he have a wife? He showed up with a woman that he'd been previously linked to, who's like a normal middle-class woman. I believe she was white. And he said, you know, this is my steady girlfriend or something. And I have no doubt that they have a romantic relationship and enjoy sleeping together. Obviously not gay if you look at him, from what I can tell. But, you know, I think there's some different dynamics going on.
Okay, so it's weird strategy for a Republican man not to be married with kids. But you're saying Tim Scott's maybe kind of a special case, whereas particularly the woman he's attracted to, dates, whatever, it actually wouldn't strategically be smart necessarily for him to leave. Okay,
if Tim Scott is a working class black guy from the Carolinas and he dates women that he would have been attracted to during his younger days, who are perfectly nice, honorable women, I can virtually guarantee that that would not actually help Tim Scott electorally. Now, I'm kind of talking on my ass here. I don't know everyone Tim Scott's dated. But I mean, like, just from that demographic profile and from the two women or so that I've seen him linked to, like, I could see why he would strategically do that.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not hard to see.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, there is an element of strategy when you get to that level. Like, you also don't want people trapped in dead marriages. This is another thing. Like, I mean, there are people like Ron DeSantis and Casey DeSantis that obviously like each other. But there obviously seems to be some intimacy left there. They got four kids or whatever. Right. And they're both have busy careers. But I mean, like, there's like Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Where you have like ruthless ambition. Neither one of them is necessarily conventionally, sensually beautiful. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they'd have to have a really strong animal attraction to each other for that marriage to work out. And they clearly don't.
They
liked each other as casual friends in law school. They married, I would guess, to further their career. I'm not suicidal. And you know, so you wind up with a situation where you have these two very dangerous people who are quite likely no longer in love, just living together.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of that on the GOP, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And that often is where you have politicians that are having these crazy affairs where they're slapping women on the ass at airports or like tapping their foot under the door of stalls at other men. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think if you're really just, you want to be a playboy for four more years, it's probably best not to get married.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That's a different take. Yeah, and I didn't know what type of women Tim Scott was linked to, but now I'm going to look into that a little bit. But that's a fair take and interesting. That's why I brought it to you, Will. Okay. Let's wrap it up here with your 10 questions. I know you got places to be and things to do. Okay. Question number one, you can have dinner with any living person on earth. Who would you pick?
Tom Sowell, probably.
Who would you play in a movie? Who would play you in a movie? Sorry. Who would play you in a movie?
Play me in a movie? Probably The Rock.
Black History Month, yay or nay?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I think that I'll actually go into this one for like a second. I think that the issue with all this stuff, like International Women's Day, which in the 70s, you planned a nice dinner, took your wife to it. I mean, the problem is only like the last 15 or so years of wokeness. Mm-hmm. Of course, there should be Black History Month, St. Patrick's Day, so on. The problem is only that this has grown to fill the entire calendar with all the days for minorities and ethnic whites and the 2 months for gay people and, mm-hmm. you know, and a month for trans people. And so people are getting a little sick of it, you know, but I think that last category, you'd certainly trim back a little bit before you get to Black History Month and St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing inherently wrong with that now.
Okay. What is the best part of waking up?
Folgers in your coming. No, just like I don't like waking up very much. I mean, I would say probably meditation or caffeination or something like that, getting ready for the day.
Who is the most overrated Black intellectual?
I mean, it's very easy to be vicious here. I would say that the prize doesn't necessarily just go to Ibram Kendi or Ta-Nehisi Coates or one guy, but it would go to that whole category of people that basically discuss being Black and victimized. They're all saying the same thing.
Mm. Should we tear down statues of slaveholders?
No. I mean, this again gets into I think that there's no ultimate right or wrong in the eyes of, you know, the old gods. There obviously are things that we today view as bad, and I think that we've advanced ethically in terms of our perspective on most of these. But looking around historically, almost every male, I don't know why I'd sexualize this, Boddicca and all that. Almost every conqueror back in the day was a slaveholder, mm-hmm. because that's what you did with defeated enemies, unless you're just going to kill and eat them.
Right.
So, I mean, like Shaka Zulu, Genghis Khan, like we're not going to tear down statues of everybody ever to live.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't think that makes any sense at all.
Are golfers athletes?
Yeah, a sport is just a competitive enterprise involving other people. Like, there's an old line, it's not a sport unless there's defense, but that would exclude track, cross-country, swimming, so on down the line.
Should the United States return to the gold standard?
No, that when people say that, it's completely idiotic. We could come up with something like a silicon standard where there's Bitcoin or something that backs each dollar, but no, there's not enough gold. There's one gold unit for something like every $1,000 we have.
Do you think you could kill a person in self-defense?
Oh, yeah.
What is your favorite?
I think I could kill an adult male warrior for money. I mean, like, this whole pretense that, like, there's some, it's incredibly difficult to deal violence. I am not an extraordinarily violent person. Like, despite having a hood upbringing, I'm actually kind of proud. I've never killed anyone. I walked a scholar's path. But yeah, like someone breaks in my house, they're getting shot. Like the idea that I would have nightmares about that for years or something, there's no evidence of that at all for healthy women or men. No.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And your final question, what is your favorite board game?
Chess.
Of course, you're going to pick the smart guy board game. No Candyland for you. No, no sorry.
Monopoly would be second.
Okay. All right, Will, I know you're on a tight timeline. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with us before you sign off?
I really love Free Black Thought. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, we'll talk to you again soon.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.